Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really amazing founder, you know, a founder that, we're going to be learning quite a bit when it comes to Web3, what he's done. You know, he's been around the block, really incredible journey. And again, we're going to be talking about building, scaling, financing, all of that good stuff that we like to hear. We're talking about the early days of Web3, some of the challenges that were going on there. ICOs, you know, the initial coin offerings that he was involved with, as well as doing roll up, you know, of companies, you know, and what they're doing now with raising money, partnerships with the likes of Warner Brothers. I mean, you name it, all in between. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Aaron McDonald. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. Really great to be on board. Sounds like an exciting show ahead. Hopefully we can make up for that incredible introduction.
So let's talk about that walk through memory lane, because you were born in New Zealand in a small rural town. So walk us through how was life, you know, growing up?
Yeah, the bottom of the world and the bottom of nowhere inside of New Zealand. It was actually great being a kid growing up in that environment. You know, being in the outdoors and, you know, connected to the land, and that's something that's always grounded me. We were dirt poor and we had a big family, but you know, we had lots of fun, and it was really, I think, a shaping part of my life to grow up in that environment and spend time in somewhere that is kind of the opposite of where I've landed now in terms of high tech and content and gaming in the metaverse.
So then let's talk about traveling, because obviously as a young kid, you know, you traveled a lot through Southeast Asia. And like anything, you know, traveling gives you a new worldview. You know, you didn't probably at that point, you didn't know that there was life outside of New Zealand. And then you're like, my God, there's like other stuff happening outside of this country. So what would you say, you know, that opened up your worldview there? Because even you at a young age, you know, later on at 17, you would also travel to Russia for humanitarian work and stuff like that. So how was that for you?
Yeah, so one of the things my parents did actually was they did humanitarian work, and we actually spent a year in Southeast Asia. My dad was over there teaching people how to be more effective in their farming practices and get higher yields, and so got exposed to both a completely different culture from my own, as well as you know, the good work of helping other people to be successful. And so that kind of also was a shaping moment for me and carried on through the rest of my life. I think it was fun. I have some really fond memories of my time back then, even though I was quite young, but it did give you a totally different perspective. I think one thing is true, though, that Kiwis, New Zealanders are typically outward focused because we are, you know, in the middle of nowhere compared to the rest of the world. And we kind of have to look outside of our own country, and a high percentage of New Zealanders when they're young take off and travel overseas. And so I kind of followed a little bit in my father's footsteps, spent some time up in Russia, working again in humanitarian causes, helping build orphanages and run soup kitchens and bring in aid to kind of poorer villages and stuff like that. So it was as a really, you know, I think giving time in my own personal development to see people in, even though I grew up poor, in a worse position than me, and give you that real perspective of seeing things from other people's point of view and putting yourself in other people's shoes, which kind of carried again through my whole career and trying to understand the audiences I connect with and perspective of other people in conversations or on deals. You know, all of those skills carry through.
So then for this sense too, I mean, when you went to Russia and you did that humanitarian work, you know, around 17, then you decide to go back to New Zealand. And then at 21, obviously, you know, you had the biggest startup that that one human being could have. But the thing is that in this type of startup, you know, there is no exit. You only break even when you sleep at night. And that's pretty much it. But what happened at 21? Because it changed the perspective of everything.
Yeah, I obviously fell in love and got married at that time. Came back to New Zealand, and I found out on my 21st birthday that my wife at that time was pregnant with my son, Misha. And that was almost, I don't want to say a wake-up call, because it wasn't that I was doing nothing with my life, but changed the focus from, you know, being someone who was kind of almost solely focused on the outward world into someone who had to be a bit more focused on the inward world. And create a home and a stability for my new family. And so I jumped from that moment, you know, into the technology world, something that I'd played around a bit with as a kid. You know, even though we were very poor, my mum and dad worked, you know, double shifts to get us a computer, an Amiga 500. And we taught ourselves how to program, me and my brothers, and so I kind of naturally had always been interested in technology, always tinkered and invented and played with electronics as a kid. And one of my friends was working in IT and got me a job at the ground level, we should say, you know, crawling around underneath buildings and laying cables for an IT company. And that's kind of started my technology career from there.
So then for you, I mean, it was quite the career, you know, and all types of sequences of events, because you started in corporate and now obviously you're in the startup world. So how do you go from corporate into venture? I mean, what did that transition look like for you?
I always kind of had a hunger to learn new stuff. And so I spent a lot of my career working in different parts of the business to understand how they worked. So I spent time, like I said, literally on the ground level out in the field, you know, building the infrastructure of the internet, and then moved more into kind of core network technology roles, you know, helping kind of bring voice over IP and mobile networks to life. Jumped from there into spend some time in sales to understand how that worked, technology sales or technical sales, and from there into product, and then from product, you know, development into product management into product marketing, and then ended up kind of running a $1 billion portfolio in telecommunications and IT. And so I got a really well-rounded experience through that journey of all the different elements of a business. And I think that was really important to me, stepping from that into venture world, because when I would talk to founders or start to kind of get involved with incubating and accelerating my own companies, I could really see all the different parts that needed to come together to make something successful. And particularly when you're working in telecommunications, you know, the value proposition from a technology perspective is very thin competitively, you know, when you're talking, you know, one network versus another. And so you have to really focus on the other parts of that value proposition, understand your customer segmentation, pricing, customer experience design, all of those things really make the difference. And so that put me in a really great mindset for understanding how early stage businesses should think about approaching things, because they really need to think about those customer value propositions and product market fit and all those kind of things on top of the core technology. And often people get stuck in the technology in their heads and forget about those things. So that's really kind of the career. After I jumped from kind of that business leadership role, I went and spent some time in corporate venture. I was lucky enough at the time that my boss kind of saw me in a position where I kind of looked a bit bored in the business, I think, and then offered, you know, to sponsor me to go into this new corporate venture part of the business, so I could learn the ropes there and make a decision about whether I wanted to go on in the corporate exec track or whether I wanted to go out and do my own thing. And I learned a lot in that corporate venture process, and then immediately jumped out into the startup world.
So then let's talk about making that jump. What did that jump look like for you?
It was scary, you know, like even though I went from corporate venture into a portfolio company to lead a portfolio company from the venture portfolio, you know, leaving the bosom of corporate life and, you know, all the support structures you have around you and the financial stability that comes with that and the infrastructure that exists to get things done, you know, that was a very scary moment. And you know, young family on board and kind of just trying to figure out my place in the world at that point, but really exciting. You know, I'd always think through my career, one of the things that drove me to move through those different roles was always wanting to make the thing better. You know, when you're at the very bottom of the stack running those cables, everyone else's decisions above you, you know, shit flows downhill, right? And so you try and climb to the next rung up so that you can fix the problems that you experience down below. And going through that track, you know, you'd figure out where all those gaps were. And so, you know, now being at the other end, you know, in charge of a business really kind of was a great opportunity to put all of that work to that, all that learnings to work, but also really scary because you're the one that's making those decisions.
So then in this case too, I mean, you actually started to get excited about the, you know, playing there with like smart contracts. And I think that there was a really pivotal moment there when you connected with a lawyer, you know, that was in SUG and very much involved. And, but I mean, I'm sure it was kind of like the wild, wild west, you know, at that point, you know, the early days. So what happened, you know, during that connection and what opened up, you know, the whole thing, like in your view about this world of Web3? Why was it so exciting for you?
So I think there are a few things that really drew me in. I'd kind of seen Bitcoin for a bit and I thought that was interesting. And I kind of felt that having a system where community owned the infrastructure was something that was for money was kind of interesting, but it wasn't until I saw Ethereum and smart contracts that I really got into it, because then I realized the opportunity for communities to own applications. And that meant like you went from this kind of finance and money domain into the everything domain. And so I got fascinated by the idea of building applications that communities could participate in the ownership of. And changing the paradigm. And if you think back then, you're coming out of startup, into startup world, out of corporate venture and big tech really kind of starting to make their moment. This is kind of around the times pre-Cambridge Analytica, but you could see really this kind of power transfer happening in society from two companies that were in control of the data and the processes on the internet. And my history is someone who kind of thought about, you know, humanitarian causes and understanding kind of society's role and social structures and stuff like that. It dawned on me at that time that there was this pivotal moment where we could actually change the destiny of the internet, where we could put users back in control and we could have community-owned infrastructure and we could run you know, applications in a way that meant that corporations didn't have to be in the driving seat. And I thought that that was really fascinating at that time. We saw also this kind of opportunity in being able to use a common platform that nobody owned to build businesses that could connect with each other on that platform. So if you think of like scaling a startup, often there's like a chicken and egg problem, which is, you know, might have one side of the business model, you know, going, but it needs the other side of the business model to work. Let's say like Uber, for example, you need drivers and you need customers. And if they don't come together at the right time, then it doesn't work because half the experience isn't there. And so when we're looking at this technology, we're like, well, how can businesses leverage a common platform that nobody owns, connect to customers that are in control of their own destiny and their own data and their own identity, and overcome those chicken and egg scaling problems and create a more connected venture portfolio? And at the time, we had this this kind of thesis, which was let's not try and make a unicorn, let's try and make a herd full of successful zebras. You know, because that's a much more realistic goal. And in fact, unicorns don't actually exist in reality. So so that led us down the path of creating a venture portfolio, you know, connected to this Web3 technology.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
Now, in this case, you know, like too, for you guys, obviously you were involved too with the, you know, with during the days of the venture studio that you were running too, you were involved with an ICO there with an initial coin offering that was 100 million. So ICOs, I mean, that was crazy days, the ICO. So how was that experience too of experiencing an ICO like that?
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy. I mean, you know, when we started in Web3, it was something that investors didn't really get, you know, that banks didn't really understand, you know, to kind of like do a lot of work to get a bank account. There were all sorts of misnomers and kind of preconceptions about what this technology was and wasn't. And so it was hard as a startup operating in that time just to do the basics. And then, you know, towards the end of 2017, that something changed, you know, and people started en masse to understand that value proposition, and the nature of capital raising started to change. And it wasn't just something that happened in Web3 either. You know, you were starting to see crowdfunding come into play in a bigger way around that time. It was the kind of the early days of consumerization of stock market trading. So it was all of these kind of forces combining, which the output of was that consumers were getting opportunities to invest directly in things in a way that they'd never had before. You know, there was always these gatekeepers in front of the capital process, and only a small number of participants actually could participate in early stage, you know, venture opportunities. And this new technology enabled that to scale in a totally different way. And so we did, one of our venture companies did a TGE at the time, and token generating event, to enable that company to build a network that these connected ventures could operate on top of. And so that was a extremely crazy time, because when you're kind of in the middle of that environment, it's moving so fast. There are so many like exhilarating moments. There are so many moments that are the opposite of that, that you feel like everything's going to, you know, fall to pieces. You know, prior to that, we'd been relatively successful, but never experienced something as big as that before. And so there's a whole learning process that you go through when that happens to you and after that happens to you, in that scaling of a company, that's something that you can't be prepared for no matter what you do beforehand.
So then in this case, you know, like too, I mean, one thing led to the next, and you ended up doing a roll up, you know, of all types of companies here, more on the media side of things, and that is now called Futureverse. So it's interesting, you know, like that shift from pushing a venture studio to now and being involved, obviously, with all these different companies that you had there, for example, like the one that we just alluded to. But how do you go now into doing that roll-up? You know, a roll-up is not easy. You know, it's challenging, all types of like, you know, things that you need to do to bring all these companies together. And also you did a Series A for this of $54 million. So how was that like? Because, I mean, a roll-up is challenging.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I have to say, don't try this at home, kids. yeah, it's my first kind of warning. But so in our first kind of portfolio companies, we focused on companies that were solving those infrastructure and onboarding and user experience problems around Web3. And then we grew that into a second fund that was more focused on bringing consumers in to use that technology. And in that domain, we focused on content. So we figured content would be the key to bringing users into use this technology. And we started to have success with a whole bunch of content companies in that second phase. And in that, we were incubating a company, which I actually co-founded, called Altered State Machine, which was building AI technology, the intersection of AI and Web3. And we had a few conversations with potential investors in that company, and they started to notice the rest of the ecosystem. And some of these investors were later stage, you know, growth investors, and said, you know, what one of the partners at one of those funds said, why don't you look at doing a roll up? Take, you know, these infrastructure and protocol companies, put them together with these content companies, and create something more scaled that growth stage private equity could get behind. And so we thought, yeah, why not? And then spent the next 2 years trying to pull that deal together to merge and acquire 11 companies and do that Series A funding to create Futureverse, which is a world-leading media tech company now building software for the entertainment and video games industry.
So I wanted to ask you that, you know, for this, I mean, obviously, as you were saying, you guys raised $54 million.
Yeah.
And my question there is for Futureverse. I mean, imagine if you, I mean, for investors, the vision is a big one. So if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Futureverse is fully realized,
yeah,
what does that world look like?
Yeah, so our mission is to create the foundation of what we call the open metaverse. So a little bit of context to that, because I think a lot of people, when they hear metaverse, they immediately jump to something like Roblox or, you know, the Vision Pro or those kinds of things. And while those are part of it, our view is that the metaverse is just the internet evolving, you know, internet growing up into something that is a more converged and more immersive customer experience. So if you think about, you know, the early days of the internet, we had these huge silos, you know, banking, finance, commerce, media, communications. They're all quite separate things that you did, gaming. And you went to separate places to do them, and there was really no kind of interoperability between those things. And as the internet's progressed, those things have started to converge. And so, you know, you take an early example back in my telecommunications days, there were media companies and there were communications companies, and they actually had their own separate telecommunications networks. That's how far apart they were. And then you saw social media come along and eat both of those things and create this new customer experience that was both media and communications in one go. And that progression of things has continued to happen. You know, we've seen finance start to spill into commerce with buy now, pay later. That's a singular customer experience done in one place. We've seen commerce start to spill into social with social commerce. You know, fastest growing commerce platforms in the world are the likes of TikTok, where we're making a more immersive, more connected, more converged kind of commerce in that social domain. And so the metaverse is just that trend continuing, bringing more and more things into a cohesive customer experience. So in that backdrop, you know, what our job, you know, the mission we have is to create a platform that makes it possible for users to traverse all of those different applications and content experiences in a way that means they can own their identity, their content, their data, the things that they value. So that's kind of about the data layer of the internet. The next bit is about creating tools that mean that content can be interoperable. So I can own a piece of content, say an avatar, in one place, and I can take it to another place. And then the last bit that we do is help people generate that content. So using, we have really great team of, you know, 20 or so PhDs and researchers building at the edge of AI technology and content creation, creating novel models for music generation, 3D generation, all this kind of stuff, to put the control back in the hands of users so that they can create this content. It doesn't have to be some big studio or big business anymore. And when you do that, then, you know, what happens over the life of the internet, what we've seen is every time you give consumers the tools to create a type of content, that type of content becomes the default type of content that's on the internet. So, you know, back in the day, it was hard to make websites. You had to have a programmer to do that. If you knew them, they were expensive. And then things like Squarespace and Wix and WordPress came along, and suddenly every business could have a website. The same thing happened with social media. Everyone could become a publisher at that point. And so that became the default kind of media. And we're going to see the same thing again with immersive content. You know, these tools will enable everyone to create immersive content, and that will be the default kind of content that people have on the internet. And so if we're successful, communities and users will be at the heart of those things. They'll be the owners of that infrastructure. They'll be owners of that content, and we'll change the way the internet structure works.
So then I guess, you know, this is incredible. I guess now, you know, obviously that you've been at it for so long, right? As a founder, and seeing all types of shapes and forms of companies as well. I guess if I was to put you into a time machine, mm-hmm. and I brought you back in time, you know, maybe to that moment where you were now thinking about doing something of your own, and you had the opportunity right there on the spot to give your younger self one piece of advice, what would that be and why? And don't tell me to buy more Bitcoin.
it's a fascinating question. I often look at this one myself, and I was one of the answers, if I kind of start with answering it with someone else's perspective, I think this question was asked of the founder of NVIDIA, and his response is something I can really identify with, which is don't do it, you know, because the tax it extorts on your life and your family and those around you and your health and all of those things is high. And so on one hand, that's in my head because I know all of those things to be true. You know, I've put a lot of strain on my family over the years as we kind of got this thing bootstrapped. You know, it's had an impact on, you know, early days has had an impact on relationships, and even now, you know, you're juggling all these balls and you've got all this responsibility, and it's something that never leaves your mind and your attention, not only responsibility to the mission that you're doing, but also to the hundreds of people that work for you, and your investors and all of that kind of stuff. So it's a hard road to go down, and it's not for the faint-hearted. But at the same time, on the other side of the coin is there's so much joy, you know, and, you know, you see the things you imagine come to life, and you see people using those products and them getting joy from them. And so there's this huge roller coaster of things. And so the cut through on that really is, you know, I would have told myself maybe to prepare myself for that journey a bit better. And I would have told myself to take more time in the decisions I made along the way and the people that I got into business with. Because when you're in the middle of, you know, some of these very exciting moments and you get your first slug of capital, you tend to like rush into like bigger and better and all this kind of stuff. And I think just taking time really would have helped. And then the other thing was just kind of make sure, you know, to do what I think I've done in this is like keep my family close, you know, and have that core support framework around you so that you can, you know, traverse these highs and lows with some kind of center of gravity.
Amazing. So Aaron, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, you can hit me up on Twitter's probably, X is the thing I'm most on. So at AaronMCDNZ, or come and check our website out, futureverse.com. There's lots of contact links there, depending on what you want to do. If you're a developer or if you're a brand or if you're a studio that wants to work with someone doing exciting things like we are, then we're here to help.
Amazing. Well, hey, Aaron, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Thank you. No, I appreciate it.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.